We're going to begin the Peter Dale Scott article, once again entitled Bush and North, the Task Force on Combating Terrorism, from Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 33, from the winter of 1990. In his introduction, Peter Dale Scott begins, "Media concern with the Iran-Contra affair suddenly vanished in the spring of 1988, as soon as it became clear that George Bush, one of the scandal's dramatis personae, would soon become his party's presidential candidate. On the surface, the Iran-Contra controversy might indeed seem to have subsided. U.S. arms sales to Iran appear to have ceased. Overt military aid to the Nicaraguan Contras now appears a remote possibility, although we should not forget that its successor, quote, humanitarian assistance, unquote, was exactly what Oliver North called the arms he was supplying to the Contras via Richard Secord's, quote, enterprise, unquote. And yet there remains a disturbing institutional legacy from the Iran-Contra era which was responsible for the flagrant abuses of covert power. This legacy is the secret counterterrorism apparatus that was assembled under the auspices of then-Vice President Bush and which became the vehicle for Oliver North's extraordinary influence within the government. With the worldwide decline in the number of private terrorist incidents, there is even more reason to review the powerful and still intact counterterrorism apparatus organized under the Reagan administration, whose overall coordinator in the National Security Council, or NSC, was Colonel Oliver North. The last sentence again, because it's a critical one. With the worldwide decline in the number of private terrorist incidents, there is even more reason to review the powerful and still intact counterterrorism apparatus organized under the Reagan administration, whose overall coordinator in the National Security Council, or NSC, was Colonel Oliver North. The 1987 congressional investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal revealed in passing how North and his counterterrorism associates in other agencies abused the secret institutions of this apparatus to bypass legal restrictions and to further the controversial Iran arms sales. In fact, it was through the auspices of Vice President Bush's Task Force on Combating Terrorism that North began his rise to power and infamy in the U.S. government. Last sentence again. In fact, it was through the auspices of Vice President Bush's Task Force on Combating Terrorism that North began his rise to power and infamy in the U.S. government. The next section of Scott's article is entitled Bush, North, and domestic repression. Now, in this particular section, we're going to take a look at the precursor of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism and note several things. Note that already George Bush, again, former director of the CIA, and Oliver North are working together under what is termed here, quote, crisis management. And indeed, crisis management is basically what we are looking at. Terrorism or counterterrorism is simply a subset or an example of, quote, crisis management. And ultimately, the main focus of RFA 38 is the evolution of the infrastructures that Scott has already alluded to, their evolution far beyond the scope of terrorism slash counterterrorism, and the evolution of infrastructures within our national security establishment, which have been used in the past to bypass the democratic machinery of American government, and which ultimately could be used in the future to bypass once again, or if necessary, eliminate the democratic institutions of American government in response to any one of a number of, quote, unforeseen, unquote, emergencies, whether a terrorist incident, an ecological or economic or political disaster. Beginning this particular section of Peter Dale Scott's article, oh, also, before I begin it, note also that among the things that grew out of this cooperation between Bush and North in, quote, crisis management, unquote, were the contingency plans to establish martial law in the United States. I've gone into those in Radio Free America program number 32, and we're going to come back to those in a big way in this particular program. Peter Dale Scott writes, "This article will examine how the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism served as the springboard for Oliver North's operations both in the U.S. and abroad. This revealing aspect of the relationship between North and Bush has often been overlooked in the mainstream media and provides evidence of just how deeply Bush was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. We will begin by reconstructing from the public record what little is known of the Bush-North collaboration in the area of domestic repression, including the contingency plans developed by North under Bush's auspices for the roundup, and deportation of, quote, terrorist aliens, unquote. Last sentence again. We will begin by reconstructing from the public record what little is known of the North Bush collaboration in the area of domestic repression, including the contingency plans developed by North under Bush's auspices for the roundup and deportation of, quote, terrorist aliens, unquote. Of course, that roundup and deportation was one of the things subsumed under the Rex 84 Operation Night Train martial law contingency plans. Continuing with Scott's account, the little-noticed secret relationship between North and the Office of the Vice President goes back at least to 1982, when North was the National Security Council Staff Coordinator for Crisis Management. Bush at this time was charged by National Security Decision Directive No. 3, NSDD3, with responsibilities for crisis management and had been reported to be the head of a cabinet-level crisis management committee. North's secretary, Fawn Hall, joined him in February of 1983, and the two then worked on the development of a secret crisis management center. North also met with members of the Office of the Vice President on such related committees as the Crisis Pre-Planning Committee and the National Security Planning Group. There has been much debate as to what this first phase of North's work on crisis management involved. On July 5, 1987, the Miami Herald reported that North, quote, helped draw up a controversial plan to suspend the Constitution in the event of national crisis such as nuclear war, violent and widespread internal dissent, or national opposition to a U.S. military invasion abroad. Last sentence again. By the way, this Miami Herald article was reproduced in large measure in Radio Free America number 32. That it was read into the record. That program was replayed a number of weeks ago here, right here on KFJC. Beginning again with these last couple of sentences, there has been much debate as to what this first phase of North's work on crisis management involved. On July 5, 1987, the Miami Herald reported that North, quote, helped draw up a controversial plan to suspend the Constitution in the event of national crisis such as nuclear war, violent and widespread internal dissent, or national opposition to a U.S. military invasion abroad, unquote. The plan allegedly envisaged the roundup and internment of large numbers of both domestic dissidents, some 26,000, and aliens, perhaps as many as 300,000 to 400,000, in camps scattered across the country. In June of 1986, a new, quote, Alien Border Control Committee, unquote, was established, again quoting, to implement specific recommendations made by the Vice President's Task Force on Terrorism regarding the control and removal of terrorist aliens in the U.S., unquote. One of its working groups was charged with conducting, quote, a review of contingency plans for removal of selected aliens, unquote. This, these last couple of sentences again, because these sentences in many ways are the key here, and they will establish the main theme and focus of RFA 38, which, as I've indicated, is going to go way beyond the issue of terrorism and counterterrorism to the issue of completely eliminating the democratic machinery in the United States, a democratic with a small d, in the event of any one of a number of possible crises. In June of 1986, a new, quote, Alien Border Control Committee, unquote, was established, again quoting, to implement specific recommendations made by the Vice President's Task Force on Terrorism regarding the control and removal of terrorist aliens in the U.S., unquote. One of its working groups was charged with conducting, quote, a review of contingency plans for removal of selected aliens, unquote. These contingency plans, quote, relating to alien terrorists, anticipated that the INS may be tasked with apprehending and removing from the U.S. a sizable group of aliens, unquote, and again called for housing, quote, up to 5,000 aliens in temporary tent temporary quarters at a camp in Oakdale, Louisiana. In parentheses, besides temporary, is tents. As the designated coordinator of counterterrorism in the National Security Council, North would certainly have known of these contingency plans, which, disturbingly enough, appear to still be with us. Last sentence again. As the designated coordinator of counterterrorism in the National Security Council, North would certainly have known of these contingency plans, which, disturbingly enough, appear to still be with us. In the televised Iran-Contra congressional hearings, North was asked by Representative Jack Brooks, Democrat of Texas, to discuss the alleged contingency plan to suspend the U.S. Constitution. Daniel Inouye, I-N-O-U-Y-E, Democrat of Hawaii, the committee chairman, twice intervened, ruling that the question was, quote, highly sensitive and classified, unquote, and should only be discussed in executive session. The next day, North told Senator David Boren, Democrat of Oklahoma, a much more pliant questioner, that to his knowledge, the United States had no such plan, quote, in being, unquote, and that he had not participated in it. One of the things we're going to be looking at in weeks to come is the rioting in Los Angeles in the spring of 1992 and the behavior of the Immigration and Naturalization Services and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, under whose auspices the martial law contingency plans were established, because indeed aliens, quote aliens, unquote, were summarily rounded up and deported. And I would note too that the military in the rioting in Los Angeles was issued orders marked Garden Plot, an Operation Garden Plot slash Cable Splicer. It, during the late 1960s and 70s, was the genesis for the martial law contingency plans. We'll be going into that in weeks to come. The next segment of Peter Dale Scott's article is entitled The Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. Skipping down into the section, we find, in April of 1984, North drafted another National Security Decision Directive creating a new counterterrorism planning group, the Terrorist Incident Working Group, or TIWG, to rescue U.S. hostages in Lebanon and, above all, CIA Station Chief William Buckley. North became the chair of the new counterterrorist group, and TIWG's first major action was the October 1985 interception and capture of the hijackers of the Achille Lauro, which gave a big boost to North's prestige inside the administration. Last sentence again. North became the chair of the new counterterrorist group, and TIWG's first major action was the October 1985 interception and capture of the hijackers of the Achille Lauro, which gave a big boost to North's prestige inside the administration. Now, vis-a-vis the Achille Lauro incident, in the past we have looked at information from the foreign press indicating that Manzer El-Kassar, an associate of U.S. intelligence, one of the major players on the international terrorism and drug and arms trafficking stage, a collaborator of Oliver North's and U.S. intelligence in the Iran-Contra scandal, that none other than Manzer El-Kassar helped arm the hijackers of the Achille Lauro and then helped those hijackers, including apparently Abu Abbas himself. I'm not sure off the top of my head whether Abu Abbas, but certainly the hijackers were then helped by Manzer El-Kassar, some of them anyway, to escape from Oliver North. And within a very short period of time, Oliver North was actually working with Manzer El-Kassar on the Aria deal. Note also that Manzer El-Kassar has apparently enjoyed the protection of U.S. intelligence, and also the U.S. ambassador to Spain, former U.S. ambassador Joseph Zapala, a George Bush political protege. We've gone into that, by the way, in Radio Free America program number 35 and its addenda, note, and also some information in RFA 38. But note again that Oliver North's first major action as chair of the new counterterrorist group, and again, this counterterrorist group, the Terrorist Incident Working Group, or TIWG, was one of the things that grew out of the North-Bush collaboration on crisis management. The first major accomplishment, to capture the hijackers of the Achille Lauro. Those hijackers were armed by U.S. intelligence functionary Manzer El-Kassar, a major player on the international terrorist stage as well as arms and drug trafficking stage. And, of course, again, Manzer El-Kassar, a collaborator of Oliver Norris in the Iran-Contra scandal. Continuing with Peter Dale Scott's account, by the way, I want to apologize for going through many of these things quickly. One of the reasons that I do these archive shows is to lay out the documentation upon which the lines of argument presented here are based. And in the aforementioned Radio Free America number 35, which with its addenda is now many, many hours in length, the background discussion for the North Al-Kassar collaboration is, so well, the information is set forth at length. See also, by the way, Radio Free America program number 32, which I replayed a few weeks back. Continuing with Scott's account. In July of 1985, the Reagan administration convened the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. Then, on January 20th, 1986, following the recommendations of an official report of the task force, National Security Decision Directive 207 institutionalized North's role as coordinator of the administration's counterterrorism program. Last two sentences again, because they're pivotal. In July of 1985, the Reagan administration convened the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. Then, on January 20, 1986, following the recommendations of an official report of the task force, National Security Decision Directive 207 institutionalized North's role as coordinator of the administration's counterterrorism program. He was given a secret office and staff, the Office to Combat Terrorism, that were kept hidden from certain members of the National Security Council. Possibly the only official reference to NSDD 207 appears in a letter of April 17, 1987, from FBI Executive Assistant Director Oliver B. Revell, R-E-V-E-L-L, to Senator David Boren, Democrat of Oklahoma, Chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, explaining some of the contacts which he and the FBI had with Oliver North. This document, which explains North's exact duties, is quoted here at length. At the time, April of 1986, Colonel North was the NSC official charged by the President with the coordination of our national counterterrorist program. He was responsible for working closely with the designated lead agencies and was responsible for participating in all interagency groups, maintaining the national programming documents, assisting in the coordination of research and development in relation to counterterrorism, facilitating the development of response options, and overseeing the implementation of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism recommendations. This description of Colonel North's position is set forth in the public report of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, February 1986. There is an even more detailed and comprehensive description of Colonel North's position in the classified National Security Decision Directive No. 207 issued by the President on January 20, 1986. That, by the way, is the letter from Revell to David Boren. Continuing with Scott's text, two key members of Bush's task force staff, Robert Earl, E-A-R-L, and Craig Coy, C-O-Y, moved over to staff North's new office. Earl and Coy, by the way, again, note that they came from Bush's task force staff. Continuing with Scott's text, Earl and Coy spent much of the next year working on the Iran arms sales and a Contra support operation, making it easier for North to travel. While working for North, Earl and Coy were in fact officially attached to the Crisis Management Center, where North had worked in 1983. Last sentence again. While working for North, Earl and Coy were in fact officially attached to the Crisis Management Center, where North had worked in 1983. The next section of Peter Dale Scott's article is entitled, appropriately enough, Bush's Lies. Bush's political autobiography, Looking Forward, gave the impression that he had only minimal acquaintance with North and the Iran arms sales initiative. The vice president acknowledged only two contacts with North, during the Grenada operation and when he telephoned North from Israel before meeting that country's top representative in the Iran arms deals. He admitted knowing of the secret trip by North and Robert McFarlane to Tehran, but denied knowing of North's, quote, other secret operations, unquote, before November of 1986. North's diaries suggest, however, that in this period, he was in recurring contact with Bush, Bush's advisors, and the other members of Bush's task force. From July of 1985 to January of 1986, when the secret end run around George Shultz on Iran arms sales was devised, the available pages of North's diaries, most remained classified by the government, show only one meeting with President Reagan. However, the diaries show four meetings with Vice President Bush, either alone or with Amiram Nir, the top Israeli counterterrorism expert, or in the presence of Donald Gregg. In addition, there are at least six recorded meetings between North and members of the Vice President's task force during this period. The Operations Subgroup, or OSG, an interagency creation of the task force and NSDD 207, was convened for the first time on January 7, 1986, the day that Shultz and Caspar Weinberger vigorously opposed the Iran arms sales plan. The OSG met twice again that month, but its members appear to have been already meeting with North under the auspices of the Restricted Terrorist Incidents Working Group, or RTIWG, months earlier. Recall that earlier we took a look at the TIWG, the Terrorist Incidents Working Group, whose first major action was the capture of the Achille Lauro kidnappers, and again, the relationship between the Achille Lauro people and Manzer al-Qassar we've noted in the past, and the Abu Abbas group, which was responsible for that, was very close to Manzer al-Qassar. This is a refinement of that, and this is not the TIWG, but the RTIWG, the Restricted Terrorist Incidents Working Group. By the way, don't worry too much about the nomenclature here. I would strongly encourage people to tape the programs. That's what these broadcasts are intended for, so that you'll have the record on hand. But note simply that the TIWG, the RTIWG, and the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, they are developments of the North Bush collaboration on crisis management, and ultimately, quote, crisis management, including, if necessary, martial law. Had these contingency plans and these infrastructures grew out of this evolutionary pattern that we're looking at. The Scott text continues here. The diaries also show at least 14 other meetings between North and the task force's senior members, Admiral James Holloway, H-O-L-L-O-W-A-Y, Ambassador Robert Oakley, O-A-K-L-E-Y, Charles Allen, A-L-L-E-N, its principal consultant, Terry Arnold, A-R-N-O-L-D, and its staff, Robert Earle and Craig Coy. As I speak this evening, and this evening is February 21st of 1993, Robert Oakley, a key member of the State Department contingent for the Vice President's Task Force and the RTIWG working with Oliver North, Robert Oakley is the U.S.'s special ambassador to Somalia. Skipping down in Scott's text, actually not skipping down, but continuing, I should say, in his testimony, North suggested an even more intimate relationship with Bush. He told the committee that, quote, when my father died, there were three people in the government of the United States that expressed their condolences, unquote. Two of these were Admiral Poindexter and William Casey, his top bosses in the Iran-Contra covert operations. The third was, quote, the Vice President of the United States, unquote. Though they seem to have worked chiefly on the Iran arms deals and the Contra supply operation, North and his two staffers, Robert Earle and Craig Coy, operated at the heart of a whole complex of controversial secret operations in 1986. Earle himself testified that he spent between a quarter and a half of his time on Iran matters. His colleague Coy, quote, knew everything about Democracy Incorporated, unquote, the Contra support operation. Earle and Coy also took the minutes for the Interagency Operations Subgroup. So again, note here that what originally was set up to, quote, combat terrorism, unquote, was ultimately used by North and Company to bypass the democratic machinery of American government and, in fact, to begin trafficking weapons to the Iranian Islamic fundamentalists who were deeply involved in supporting the very terrorism that these people were supposedly combating. The next section of Peter Dale Scott's article is called Others Involved, and it reads, by establishing a special apparatus to combat terrorism, the Reagan administration and the Bush task force in particular created an ongoing network able to bypass normal channels and proceed with an Iran arms sales policy that was opposed by both Secretary of State Shultz and Secretary of Defense Weinberger, as well as the area desk officers in their departments and in the CIA. Last sentence again, because in many ways it's a thesis statement for this article. By establishing a special apparatus to combat terrorism, the Reagan administration and the Bush task force in particular created an ongoing network able to bypass normal channels and proceed with an Iran arms sales policy that was opposed by both Secretary of State Shultz and Secretary of Defense Weinberger, as well as the area desk officers in their departments and in the CIA. It is therefore important to consider the other players involved in the counterterrorism apparatus, because this will help demonstrate the scope and depth of the network. This apparatus, while clearly not some sort of well-planned and thought-out conspiracy, is more accurately described as a cabal. It was created as an arrangement which suited all parts of the Reagan administration, including those who preferred to have no responsibility for a policy selling arms to Iran, which they could not bring themselves to support. This consensual sidestepping of responsibility, or what we might call, quote, guiltlessness by dissociation, unquote, was not even limited to the administration. I would interrupt here. There is what I personally consider to be something of a semantic consideration here. Scott points out, accurately in my opinion, this apparatus, while clearly not some sort of well-planned and thought-out conspiracy, is more accurately described as a cabal. I think this is essentially a semantic distinction and no more than that. A rose by any other name, likewise a pile of horse manure, whether you call it, you can call it a cabal, or you can call it a conspiracy, or you can call it your mother. The fact of the matter is, it is basically what it is. While undoubtedly features of this evolutionary structure that we're looking at, this evolutionary process in which counterterrorism ultimately gave rise to institutions which have functioned as a covert government within a government, while no doubt some of it was ad hoc and evolved as the situation dictated, at the same time, the genesis of the martial law contingency plans, for example, goes all the way back to the steps taken to combat not only the anti-Vietnam War movement, but the Black Power and Civil Rights movement, as we'll look at next week and in weeks to come, Operation Garden Plot and Cable Splicer, which were conducted in the United States as a whole and in California, ultimately gave rise to the personages of Louis Jufrida and his deputy, Frank Salcido. They gave rise to the martial law contingency plans, and indeed, there have been attempts in this country to establish martial law going all the way back to the 1934 coup attempt that we reviewed last week. So, although features of this no doubt were invented and created as the process went along and as reality dictated, or as the necessity dictated in the minds of the individuals who created these institutions, at the same time, I think the evolution of these things goes back a long way, and it should not be thought of as a spontaneous process, but rather a long-term evolutionary process, elements of which were clearly defined and elements of which evolved and became clarified as the situation proceeded. Again, I think there's a semantic consideration. You can call it a conspiracy, a word which, in my opinion, has no meaning at this point. Rather, the word conspiracy has become rather like the word liberal became in the 1980s. Liberal became a dirty word. Conspiracy has also become a dirty word and consequently does not have a lot of meaning. You can call it a conspiracy or a cabal, or you can call it your mother, but it's the same thing. And whatever you choose to call it, we have it, and we've got to deal with it. It's why this Peter Dale Scott article is so important. Continuing with Scott's text here. The true cabal appears to have consisted largely of those middle-level operatives brought together by their responsibility for counterterrorism, a group including not only Northam Poindexter, but the CIA's Dwayne Claridge, C-L-A-R-R-I-D-G-E, and the quintet who moved from developing and reviewing the, quote, counter-terrorist, unquote, policies with North at the Bush Task Force Senior Review Group to executing them with North through the Operations Subgroup. The five were Charles Allen of the CIA, Robert Oakley of State, Noel Koch, K-O-C-H, of the Defense Department, Lieutenant General John Mollering, M-O-E-L-L-E-R-I-N-G, from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Oliver Revell of the FBI. Some of these men survived in the Reagan administration unscathed, despite having responsibilities for the Iran-Contra affair that would seem at least comparable to North's. Note again that Robert Oakley of the State Department, very much on the scene today as he commands the U.S. effort, or oversees the U.S. effort in Somalia. Continuing with Scott's text. It can be argued that these men were not only accomplices of North's in the execution of the controversial Iran arms sales, but the true authors of the counterterrorism gambit which led a Marine lieutenant colonel to act in defiance of official U.S. policy. Last sentence again, because it's critical. It can be argued that these men were not only accomplices of North's in the execution of the controversial Iran arms sales, but the true authors of the counterterrorism gambit which led a Marine lieutenant colonel to act in defiance of official U.S. policy. For example, in 1985 and 86, Robert Oakley was the director of the State Department's Office to Combat Terrorism. In this capacity, he served first on the Bush Task Force Senior Review Group and then co-chaired the Operations Subgroup, or OSG, with North until about July of 1986. He then resigned from the administration, allegedly because he disagreed with the Iran arms sale policy of North. One of National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci's early acts of post-Iran-Contra housecleaning in 1987 was to bring Robert Oakley back from private life to the National Security Council. Oakley now serves as U.S. ambassador to Pakistan. I would mention that this, of course, is in the winter of 1990. Now he's our special ambassador to Somalia. Continuing with Scott's account, it is noteworthy that the Iran arms deals with Ghorbanifar, Ghorbanifar, although they had been proposed as early as November of 1984, were blocked until the Bush Task Force began to operate in July of 1985. Note again that the Bush Task Force was supposedly to combat terrorism, and yet here it is used to circumvent institutions blocking the sales of arms to a nation which was deeply involved in supporting not only international terrorism, but terrorist incidents which killed American soldiers and citizens, such as the bombing of the U.S. Marine Corps barracks in Lebanon in 1982. Actually, 1983, make that. Continuing now with the account, with Peter Dale Scott's text here. Thereafter, the arms deals were handled by a number of bureaucrats whose common denominator and whose means of communicating directly with each other was their responsibility for counterterrorism. Last sentence again. Actually, the last several sentences again. It is noteworthy that the Iran arms deals with Ghorbanifar, although they had been proposed as early as November of 1984, were blocked until the Bush Task Force began to operate in July of 1985. Thereafter, the arms deals were handled by a number of bureaucrats whose common denominator and whose means of communicating directly with each other was their responsibility for counterterrorism. These men were Michael Ledeen, Charles Allen, Dwayne Claridge, Robert Oakley, and Oliver North for the United States, and Amiram Nir for Israel. Interrupting briefly, note that Amiram Nir died in the crash of a private plane in early December of 1988. The death of Amiram Nir, as well as the deaths of the McKee team, a group of U.S. intelligence operatives who were seeking to free the U.S. hostages being held in Lebanon and who came across the working the pattern of working cooperation between U.S. intelligence and Manzer al-Qasar. Those are the central elements in the December surprise working hypothesis, which I introduced in January of 1989. By the way, those who would like to examine that, get a hold of Radio Free America number 35, The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror, and The Exoneration of the Secret Team. Continuing now with Peter Dale Scott's account, by creating a counterterrorism network with its own secure system of intelligence communications, channels had been opened whereby other bureaucrats with opposing viewpoints could simply be excluded. The counterterrorism network even had its own, quote, special worldwide anti-terrorist computer network, codenamed Flashboard, unquote, by which members could communicate exclusively with each other and with their collaborators abroad. Those involved in the Iran arms deals appear to have used, quote, flash, unquote, messages on this secure system as late as October 31st, 1986. Note also that Michael Ledeen is an individual who was deeply involved with the P2 milieu in Italy and one of the most vocal spokespersons advocating the Bulgarian thesis in the shooting of Pope John Paul II that we discussed earlier in tonight's program. The next section of Scott's article is called The Criminals Judge the Crime, and significantly it indicates that the infrastructures created out of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism and the earlier Bush-North collaboration on crisis management, in fact, survived the Iran-Contra scandal and are intact to this day. And bear in mind that among the institutions growing out of this evolutionary process are the martial law contingency plans. We're going to come back to that next week. When Ronald Reagan admitted in March of 1987 that the arms sales to Iran were a mistake, he asked Bush to reconvene his task force, quote, to review our policy for combating terrorism and to evaluate